Hello, I'm Michael Cathcart, and you're very welcome to the summer series of Books and Arts Daily here on RN. Today, more highlights from our past year. Moby Dick goes digital, the books to read at the end of your life, and Kristen Henry's new verse novel. You'll love it. Now, I'm going to make a confession. Before we made this story, I'd never read past chapter 3 of Moby Dick. Moby Dick, of course, is an American classic by Herman Melville. It was published in 1851, and it's all about one Captain Ahab and his obsession with a great white whale. Now, I bought my copy in 1975. It's got that date in the front, and it also says here that it cost $2.25. It was my second year at university, and the pages of this book have gone all yellow and brittle, and my problem has always been that the type in this college edition is tiny. But I put that omission to rights by having Moby Dick read to me at bedtime on the internet, and I can warmly recommend the experience. The list of readers is extraordinary. It includes Tilda Swinton, Sir David Attenborough, Stephen Fry, Simon Callow, John Waters, Neil Tennant, Will Self, Benedict Cumberbatch, and one of my favourite actresses, Fiona Shaw, and some fabulous readings by people who just aren't famous at all. The man who's done so much to bring us this bedtime pleasure is Philip Hoare. Let's revisit my conversation with Philip. So you have been obsessed by Moby Dick for a very long time. How did this start?
Well, it's funny, it's like you. You know, I tried to read it at college, and I think I probably have the same edition as you, actually. Really off-putting, that small print. And it's only actually when I discovered, well, number one, I discovered a larger print edition. I mean, it not sort of, just a very nice edition, which was illustrated by the University of California Press, actually been voted the most beautiful book in the world, this wonderful edition. But then I started going to Cape Cod, where I started to see my own whales in the wild for the first time. And you're very lucky in Australia because you have pods of humpback whales disporting themselves off your coast, but we don't have that in England. And I got to Cape Cod, and you know, really my first experience of seeing a humpback whale breach in front of me was transcendental. I mean, this 40-ton, 40-foot animal just lifting itself into the air with these great sort of huge barnacled wings. It looked like some kind of cetacean angel, and I was moved. I was moved not to poetry, but to profanity, I'm afraid. My instinctive reaction was, what the?
Yeah, and, I'm with you.
But then, yeah, exactly. But then, Herman Melville, he really started to, I just started to get where he was coming from. This man who was so obsessed with whales, he would never have finished that book nowadays because he'd always be Googling whale, you know. He's tried to squeeze in between two hard covers everything he knew or fantasized about the whale. And that just completely caught me up.
So how old are you when you see these whales jumping around, breaching and carrying on?
I guess I was 30-something.
Oh,
yeah,
right.
I mean, I've been obsessed with whales since I was a kid, you know, because I don't know how old you are, Michael, but I'm sure we both grew up in the time of the Save the Whale campaigns of the 60s and 70s. And in a way, I suppose our generation was very much sensitized to the plight of the whale. And it was the first great sort of successful environmental movement. And so I suppose that's, in a way, I was very much kind of a victim of that in a way, in that I was very much attuned to the plight of the whale. I suppose specifically by the first recording of the Song of the Humpback Whale, which was made by Scott McVeigh and Roger Payne, who now lives in New Zealand. And that gave voice to these dumb animals and really was a direct corollary to what Melville had done 150 years beforehand.
It'd be good to hear some of that. Let's just hear some of that recording right now. So there you go. What a fantastic sound that is. So you inspired by these things, Philip. You actually wrote a book about this. You wrote Leviathan or the Whale, which won the Samuel Johnson Prize for Nonfiction in 2009. So this runs very deep.
It does. It's an obsession. I've been called a whale head by friends, actually. One friend accuses me of being a whale stalker. When I show my latest whale photographs, he says that's just whale porn. Mm-hmm. So it runs deep in me. Indeed, I was in Australia last year, communing with the humpbacks off Tasmania and then down in New Zealand, where there's wonderful pods of sperm whales. And I think what's very interesting about what Melville wrote about the whale and the way we see the whale now is he kind of bridges that incredible gap. You know, we're living in an age where we've gone very quickly from seeing the whale as an industrial resource to seeing it as a kind of barometer of natural threat. And that kind of disjuncture, that very quick turnaround, it's like a handbrake turn in human history. We've gone from seeing these animals as one thing to seeing them as another. It has this incredible psychic reverberation to my mind. You in Australia are very close to that because, you know, you are very much up against the modern problems that Melville was talking about, the environmental problems, but also the problems of hunting whales, which is still being done by the Japanese in waters not far from the Australian coast. So these issues that Melville was talking about, which might seem to be impossibly archaic and whatever, are actually incredibly pressing. And he was a great prophet.
A great prophet because he foresaw the crisis that we now face, or that the whales now face.
He foresaw everything. He foresaw the crisis, though. I mean, we've got a wonderful chapter read by Sir David Attenborough called Does the Whale Diminish? Will He Perish? And it's addressing, in 1851, the notion that the whale might be driven extinct by not only by hunting, but by man's effect on the environment. But more than that, or in sort of hand in hand with that, is Melville's critique of modern values, of an imperial arrogance, number one, that book was being written during the lead up to the American Civil War. So it's very much about the issues of the slave trade and of all the machinations that lead up to an internecine civil war in the States. So it's charged with that. It's charged with the notion of Ahab, who's a man going in pursuit of an animal which he invests with evil. Well, what Melville's saying is, this is stupid. Animals act according to instinct. They are not evil. They cannot be evil. Only human beings are evil. So he's turning this round to say, you know, Ahab's mad, demonic pursuit is actually the madness of human beings and of the hubris of human beings. And boy, does that have a message today.
I can remember what the question about Moby Dick was on my first year English paper at university, obviously a question I chose not to answer because I had not read the book, but it was to do with which was the hero of the novel. Was it Ahab or was it the whale, which I guess is the classic way in which the conundrum of the book is normally couched.
Such a good question. And it's interesting how many people who haven't read the book, or even actually, you probably did read it when they were kids. You know, in America, you read it in high school, which is kind of a torture to me, I think. It's a book you only can read later on, I think, or you really get later on. But it's amazing how many people think that Ahab kills the whale at the end. Now, I'm not going to spoil things for your listeners who haven't read it, but it ain't so. and that's the key issue, I think, in a way, is that struggle, you know. And Melville's talking about faith, he's talking about politics, he's talking about the great meeting of human history and natural history that was happening in his time. Remember that, you know, whale oil lubricated and lit the Industrial Revolution. Australia and New Zealand wouldn't exist if it wasn't for whaling, because they were the whaling ships that kept the colonies supplied during the early years of Australia and New Zealand. You know, New Zealand was developed because of whaling. You know, whaling exported specifically American, but also British culture around the world. It was, you know, it was the oil business of its day.
It's interesting, Philip, that aspect of Australian history is often forgotten. We often talk about Australian history as though the first great industry was wool, but actually the first great industry was sealing and whaling.
Of course it was. Of course it was. And, you know, I mean, that's why the colonies were important in a way. And of course, for Britain, it was important because we'd lost the whaling grounds off America after the American Revolution. You know, we lost that colony. We lost the ability to whale in those waters. So, you know, that focus very much switched to Australia for that reason. So that, you know, it became very important for that point.
I suppose I should say the first great industry was ochre, but then after colonisation, the first great industry was whaling. Now, I should say we're listening to Books and Arts Daily on RN, and Philip Hoare is with me, and I've asked him along because he's created this marvellous website on which you can enjoy online readings of Moby Dick, chapter by chapter. And I've been enjoying it. I'm up to chapter 10. And the first chapter, chapter 1, is read by the actor Tilda Swinton, and this is how it sounds.
Call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long precisely, having little or no money in my purse, and nothing particular to interest me on shore, I thought I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. It's a way I have of driving off the spleen and regulating the circulation. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it's a damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses, and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet. And especially whenever my hypos get such an upper hand of me that it requires a strong moral principle to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking people's hats off. Then I account it high time to get to sea as soon as I can. This is my substitute for pistol and ball.
Tilda Swinton there reading the opening lines of Moby Dick, and she goes on to read the whole of chapter one for us. Interesting that you chose a female reader to start a male story, Philip.
Well, we did that deliberately because everyone's expecting some salty tar, you know, to launch with a grizzled voice. We wanted this pure, gamine voice of this woman who, you know, is quite sort of androgynous, really, in a way, and very clear, reflecting the kind of ambiguity of that. You know, what an ambiguous opening line. It's probably the most ambiguous and possibly the most famous opening line of any work of literature. Call me Ishmael. Well, is that your name? We're not sure. And that's the great, you know, ambivalence of the book right throughout, that Melville is playing with his point of view, he's playing with you, the reader, he's playing with himself. He's perpetually undercutting himself. Do you know, one of the things that I think, actually, Michael, the reason why you and I didn't get through that book in the first place was that we didn't get the humour of it. It's such a funny book. I mean, there's not many books which devote an entire chapter to a whale's foreskin. You know, there are so hilarious aspects to the book, which, you know, we forget, I think, because we see it as a very dense Victorian, you know, 136 chapters of very dense prose. And in fact, it sings, it speaks of the ocean, it swells with the tide.
Well, as you even listening to that section that Tilda Swinton reads there, it's so playful, it's so balletic that I do wonder why I had such trouble reading on. In fact, you know, as I've opened my yellowed copy of the book and started to read it for myself and have been delighted by the prose, I can't quite understand what it was that was standing in my way the first time around.
I think, you know, being taught a book is always a bad idea. It's much better if you can discover it. And, you know, a piece of theatre works because there's an audience. A book only works because there's a reader, and there's a kind of alchemy between you and what you're reading, and you've got to allow that to happen. It can't be forced on you. You know, I discovered it because I saw whales in the wild and I suddenly tuned into what Melville was doing. You know, other people tune into this book for just the purity of the prose itself. You know, Melville was a wonderful, he made up words. He stole words. He was a great plagiarist. There are whole chunks in Moby Dick which are actually copied wholesale from other works of literature. But he gets away with it because we all know great artists steal. And he was a great thief.
How was the book taken during Melville's lifetime? Was it a classic in his own day?
Absolutely not. It totally vanished. You know, the first edition never sold out. The copies, an edition of 3,000, most of them went up in flames in a fire in his publisher's warehouse in 1856. When Melville died in 1891, he was reduced to being a customs inspector on the wharves of Manhattan. He was completely unknown. People like Henry James and Edith Wharton didn't even realize he was still alive. It took another generation for the book to be appreciated by people like D.H. Lawrence, Virginia Woolf, W.H. Auden, who in the 1920s suddenly locked into what Melville had been trying to do. In fact, D.H. Lawrence called it a work of modernism before modernism was invented. So it has this delayed time bomb effect, this book, and it has more power because of that. We're still sort of working out its reverberations in a way. It's an incredibly powerful work of literature.
Let's talk a bit more about how you've put this project together. We might hear another extract from it first, though. We spoke to Simon Kellow not so long ago, so perhaps we'll just have a little taste of him having a go at the opening lines of Chapter 9.
Father Mapple rose and, in a mild voice of unassuming authority, ordered the scattered people to condense. Starboard gangway there. Side away to larboard. Larboard gangway to starboard. Midships. Midships.
He does a pretty good accent, doesn't he?
He is a star, a total star. And I tell you what, he came down. We had a launch for this at the University of Plymouth, who have engineered this project, and Peninsula Arts there, who are the people who are responsible for staging the whole thing for us. And Simon gave this performance of that chapter in a marquee on Plymouth Hoe as the wind was battering the canvas of the tent we were in, and seagulls are skirting about, and it was, my God, the hairs on the back of your neck, you know. I mean, he's a man who just transports you. He's a glorious guy. Absolutely wonderful.
Now, I thought the reader of Chapter 10 did a good job. Let's see if the listener can work out who this is. So the setup is that we've got the book's narrator, Ishmael, in bed with a tattooed cannibal named Queequeg.
Returning to the Spouter Inn from the chapel, I found Queequeg there quite alone, he having left the chapel before the benediction some time. He was sitting on a bench before the fire with his feet on the stove hearth, and in one hand was holding close up to his face that little negro idol of his, peering hard into its face, and with a jackknife gently whittling away at its nose, meanwhile humming to himself in his heathenish way.
Isn't that delicious? Did you work out who that was? It's Stephen Fry. It took me a while to actually work out who that one was. So how did you get all these famous people to read for you? David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, reads Chapter 30. And I should say lots of the readers are not famous at all. But nevertheless, you've got some pretty big names here. How did you persuade them to do this?
I've got a good address book. Well, I have. It's actually not my address book, it is partly my address book, but I used to work in the rock business, so I kind of have connections to kind of, quote, show business through that way. And really, I was just calling in friends and friends of friends and favours. I'm not a friend of David Cameron, but I know someone who is. And actually, it was done through the university and the local Tory MP there. But, you know, trouble is that... you know, people say, oh, yeah, celebrities, you know, this is, you know, it's a bit sort of tacky. But listen, these people are celebrities because they are brilliant at what they do. Stephen Fry is a consummate reader. I mean, this is his profession. David Cameron, surprisingly, and I do not hold any, I'm not a big supporter of David Cameron for his policies, but as a reader, he was wonderful. You know, I suppose it's the Etonian in him, but actually, he was great.
But it's also very democratic. You've got a schoolboy, totally. You've got a fisherman, a local vicar.
Totally, totally. I mean, you know, we go from a 12-year-old called Cyrus Larkin Moore, who's like a schoolboy in Devon, to a fisherman, to a vicar, to care workers. It's, you know, the whole idea is to reflect the kind of very democratic notion of this ship that they were all sailing off in Moby Dick, the Pequod, which was laden with people from all around the world. You've got Maoris on that ship, you've got African Americans, you've got Native Americans. You know, it's to reflect that sort of strange sort of ship of fools, if you will, that we're all in this together. That's the whole point of this. And it's the whole point of what Melville's doing. And I think that's why he works as a writer. He's incredibly inclusive. He's not exclusive. He brings you into this. He's always assuming you are with him. And that's, again, that's part of the power of the book.
It's also interesting the way it's become part of the zeitgeist, because on the one hand, it is this 19th century book written in a 19th century register, I guess is the term. The prose feels as though it comes from a bygone time. But it does feel like a kind of spiritual parable for a secular age.
Totally. And I think another aspect of that is the fact that Moby Dick isn't edited. Melville didn't have an editor. You know, it was first published in Britain, so he was sent the manuscript across the Atlantic. In fact, his English editor did actually switch the ending around and kind of annoyed Melville that way. But generally, he wasn't edited. So it has the feeling of a modern blog, if you will, a kind of sort of stream of consciousness. And that's a very modern, if not postmodern thing. That's what gives it this sense of fluidity. And I think that really reflects Melville's own life story. He was born to be a writer, but actually, I mean, he went off on this amazing sea voyage before he ever started to write. Sailed an American whale ship to the Marquesas, where he deserted, and then hitched a ride on an Australian whale ship, actually. And it wasn't until nearly 20 years later that he actually came to write Moby Dick, or actually less than that, about 10 years later, he came to write Moby Dick. And everything poured out of him in a way. It's such a personal book because it's all the kind of everything he felt about the sea and what he'd done being brought out onto paper and spilling out. And it just spills out of him in a way.
Yes, in that wild, intrepid time he had when he was a youth. In fact, you know, often getting into trouble because to desert a ship was a very serious offence.
Absolutely. I mean, and he lived wild with the cannibalistic natives on the Marquesas. He claims for 6 months. Actually, he was probably only there for 6 weeks. But he lived in fear of having his face tattooed. He felt that he would be made unfit for Western society, that actually they might indeed cook him and eat him. I don't know. He had all these kind of preconceptions. But isn't it interesting? He introduces the first Pacific island in Western fiction, who is Queequeg, who's based on a Maori. And so he's bringing that exotic West, the Pacific, he's bringing it back to New England and interpreting those exotic notions for an enthralled Western audience.
Now, Philip, we should stop, but I don't want to stop before we mention all the art. So you've worked with Angela Kakane, who's an artist who creates biodegradable art. Just tell us how all this ties in with the website.
Well, Angela is a wonderful artist, and she has very radical and out there notions. And she always was very keen to reflect the readings with images. And so we called in images from all sorts of artists, from Anish Kapoor to Matthew Barney, Gavin Turk, Anthony Gormley, Susan Hiller, some really great contemporary artists. So every day's reading is accompanied by an image from a really great artist. And we've got some brand new artists, all responding to the theme of Moby Dick. Very interesting how many of them are female as well. You know, it's seen as such a boy's book. And there's only one female character in the book, and she's a very minor character. And yet I always counterpoint that with the notion that the sperm whales that these people were chasing are an entirely matriarchal society. And I think it's that tension that actually encouraged, you know, many female artists to respond to the theme.
And have you completed this project now?
No, we're still waiting to record a couple of the chapters. We're hoping for some really interesting names at the end of that. And so it's a very fluid project, really, in a way. And we're hoping to continue it even after the readings are done by extending it in some ways. So we're still thinking about that.
What, are you going to make up more chapters of Moby Dick? I mean, how can you, once you reach the end, my friend,
I know, but there are other ways of interpreting it, I think, which we are looking towards.
Well, look, it's a lot of fun. Philip Hoare, it's been lovely to talk to you.
It's a great pleasure, Michael. Thank you so much.
Philip Hoare. The website is called Moby Dick Big Read. We'll put a link to that on our website. And thanks to Melanie Tate from ABC Local Radio, who spotted this story and passed it on to me on RN. This is Books and Arts Daily. Well, when I was a young student, I'd go into the university library and I'd experience a kind of existential dread. There were just so many books, so much to know, and I could never possibly know even a fraction of the great universe of knowledge which was contained in all those volumes. Now, sadly, I've reached an age where I've started to do a grimmer kind of arithmetic. If the fates allow me to live a life of average length, I have just 2 decades of reading left, and that doesn't seem much. For Will Schwalbe's mother, Mary Ann, a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer made that arithmetic even starker. At 73, after a lifetime as a teacher, college administrator, refugee advocate, wife, mother, and passionate reader, she learned that she had somewhere between 2 months and 2 years left to her. So Will and his mother decided to set up a book club just for the two of them. And after Mary Ann died, Will wrote about their book club in a book that he called The End of Your Life Book Club. I spoke to Will late last year. Here's our conversation, which began with me welcoming him to the program.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me on.
Look, it's a huge pleasure. So tell us about your mother. She sounds like a force of nature.
My mom was a force of nature, but she also was a very ordinary person too. She was her proudest accomplishment, I think, was being a grandmother. But in the midst of all of that, when I was growing up, she was director of admissions at Harvard College, and then she was head of a girls' high school. And then a remarkable thing happened when she was in her 50s. She discovered the cause of refugees, and she wound up traveling all over the world advocating for refugees. She was in Liberia, she was in Gaza, Darfur, Sudan, and 10 times to Pakistan and Afghanistan.
And I get the feeling that she came from a fairly wealthy, a fairly privileged background.
Well, she came from a relatively privileged background, but she always worked both by choice and necessity. And she came from a family that had a very strong sense of giving back. And one of her great life's joys was the work she did through her church, the work she did as a refugee advocate, even the work she did in soup kitchens in New York.
Well, that's quite a strong American tradition, Will.
It is. But I know it's a strong Australian tradition as well. And one of the things I really wanted to do with this book was celebrate the kind of lives of extraordinary, ordinary people. When my mother died, she didn't have an obituary in the New York Times. She was absolutely adored by her family and friends and refugees whose lives she touched. But in some ways, I think she's very typical of so many people in our communities who do so much, who are sort of the fabric of our society. And like so many of those people, she was a passionate, passionate reader. And she looked to books to tell her what she needed to do with her life and in the world.
Well, Will, as I've said, she developed pancreatic cancer, which is a very ruthless form of cancer. People tend not to recover from pancreatic cancer. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, she'd actually just gone on a trip to Pakistan and Afghanistan, a refugee trip, and she came back and she wasn't well. And in some ways, this wasn't unusual. She often came back from her trips with some kind of illness because she was going to developing nations and to refugee camps. But this time, she stayed sick and got sicker. And after several months, they diagnosed a form of pancreatic cancer that is the most lethal cancer there is. It has no cure, and it very often kills people in 3 to 6 months. And, you know, as any family would, instantly our lives were turned upside down. And what happened was my brother, my sister, my father and I, we all took turns going with mom to various appointments because all of a sudden our lives were doctor's appointments and tests and in fact, chemotherapy. And I very often went with mom to chemo, and it was the very first time I went with her that we sort of joked that if I was there with her and we spent hours and hours talking about books, that it was kind of like a book club, a two-person book club, a mother and a son.
So one of the first books that this book club decided to read was Wallace Stegner's Crossing to Safety, which is a famous title. Why did you choose that one?
It's a book that I had always intended to read but never had. I joked that I took it on so many trips and returned it to my bedside unread so many times that if that book had had frequent flyer miles, it would have earned its own first-class ticket to Japan.
It could have crossed to safety for free.
It could have, exactly, could have crossed to safety for free and in style. And in fact, I'm not proud of this, but people would often say to me that was their favorite book, and I would sort of fib and say, I love that book. I read it, because I don't know if you're the same as me, but sometimes you don't want people telling you about books. So I would sort of fib and say I'd read it. But when I sat there and my mom is having chemo and 73 years old and has pancreatic cancer, and she says to me, "Have you read Crossing to Safety?" I wasn't going to fib to my mother. So I said, "No, in fact, I haven't." And that's the book that really kicked off our book club. And it was a very significant book for us, because we realized that books like that, great books about great things with great themes, would allow us to tackle very difficult topics. In fact, in the course of that book, there's a woman named Charity. And I'm not giving anything away when I tell this, because it's the start of the book, but she's dying of cancer. And I was able to say to Mom, "Do you think Charity's husband is going to be okay after she dies?" And Mom said, "Yeah, I think he'll be very sad, but I think he'll be okay." And of course, we weren't talking about Charity's husband. We were talking about my dad.
I mean, I noticed that quite a few of the books have to do with illness. Another book that you looked at was a book called The Last Lecture by Randy Pausch. Tell us about that.
The Last Lecture by Randy Pausch is a book that became a worldwide sensation. Randy Pausch was a professor of computer science, and there's a tradition in universities of asking people to give a kind of last lecture. And essentially saying, if you had only one lecture left to give, what wisdom would you impart? And the irony was, when they asked Randy Pausch to give a last lecture, he had in fact just been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and he knew it was indeed the last lecture he would ever give. And Randy Pausch was a much younger person than my mother. He was, I believe, in his 40s. And I wasn't sure that Mom would want to read that book. I thought maybe it would be too stark for her. So instead of giving it to her to read as sort of part of our club, I was visiting and I just left it out on a table. And I went out for a couple of hours. It's a very short book. And when I came back, she'd read it. And I asked her, "Well, what did you think?" And she had a very curious reaction. She said to me, "I feel so sorry for him." And I said, "Well, that's a sort of funny reaction, because you have exactly the same thing he has, exactly the same form of pancreatic cancer." But her answer was very typical of her. She said, "Yes, but I've lived a full life. I have grown children, and I got to have grandchildren, and he'll never get to see his children grow up." So she found it a very poignant book, but curiously, she didn't find it exactly related to her. She found her situation quite different.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, and my guest this morning is Will Schwalbe, who's on the line from America. And we're talking about his book, The End of Your Life Book Club, a club he formed with his mother, who was dying of pancreatic cancer, a club for just the two of them. Now, as you're talking here, Will, I'm thinking about your mother looking so with such clear eyes at her own situation, and then I'm thinking about you. I mean, it's not easy for you, is it? You're reading these books about, well, that relate so poignantly to the fact that your own mum is dying.
It was in many ways difficult to read books about death and dying and to read them with someone who is dying and who is your mother and who you love very much. But it was actually such a great comfort to me. One of the things that the books allowed us was really to normalize our relationship. In as much as when we're reading these books together, we weren't a sick person and a well person. We were just, again, a mother and a son, and we were on a journey together, and we were discovering new voices and learning new things. And so in the crazy world you find yourself in a hospital, in chemo, surrounded by people who have terrible, terrible illnesses, we had this little oasis of normalcy. We were doing what we'd always done all our lives, talking about books, and not just the themes, but the very act of discussing books together was a huge comfort.
So you read and you talked, and there you are sitting in hospital rooms while, as you say, she's having chemotherapy. And I was struck by one phrase you used. You said that hospitals are interruption factories. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, anyone who's ever unfortunately had to spend time in a hospital knows people come in and they check things and they ask you questions and they seem to interrupt you every couple minutes. So when you're trying to have a serious conversation, it can be difficult. But we found in some ways that was a metaphor for life, that life is an interruption factory, that whenever you're trying to connect with someone, there's your iPhone or your BlackBerry or your cell phone or people interrupting you or your own sort of disruptive mind telling you, I have to do this and I have to do that. And one of the things I really wanted to convey in the book is that we're all in this kind of end-of-your-life book club, that my mother knew she only had a limited amount of time left, but in fact, we all have a limited amount of time left, and no one knows what book is your last, what conversation is your last. So the book is really an appeal to people to make every book count, to make every conversation count.
Well, that's a good idea. We could call every book club the end of your life book club. I mean, that's your point,
every
isn't it?
Every book club is the end of your life club. It really genuinely is.
Yeah. No, I get that. So the two of you are there with your progressive politics and your books. In hospital, did it make you reflect on the U.S. healthcare system?
Oh, my mother was a passionate advocate for reforming the U.S. healthcare system. One of the reasons my mother was able to live 2 years was she had superb care. She had been a teacher, so she had great insurance as a teacher. As well, she was a certain age, and when you get to a certain age in America, you have great insurance. But she thought it was terribly unfair that so many people in America don't have access to the kind of care she had or had to bankrupt themselves in order to get it. And that's one of the reasons she was such a passionate supporter of Barack Obama, is she felt we had to do something. And there's kind of an odd story. When I was making the decision to write the book, I actually let my mother know that. A couple months before she died, I said, I want to write something about you and me and the conversations and the books. And she said, oh, don't be silly. Why would you want to do that? And don't write about me. I'm sure you have something else to write about. And then the next day, she sent me by email a list of all the books we'd read. And a couple days after that, she sent me an email that said, don't forget to talk about the need for healthcare reform.
Hmm. Oh, well, she had a sense of what the agenda was. Well, what did the rest?
She always had an agenda.
What did the rest of your family make of this activity?
Well, we're all readers, and in some ways, everybody talked to Mom about all sorts of things, including books. And so, to some degree, we were able to draw at various times everybody into it. And one of the important things to mention about Mom and my book club is, we really didn't set out to kind of read, you know, capital G great books. We read books that everybody was reading. We read The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo by Stieg Larsson. I talked a lot about The Hobbit, one of my favorite books. We read People of the Book by Geraldine Brooks and Brat Farrar by Josephine Tay. And very often a sibling or my dad had also read one of these books. So we were able to draw them into the conversation as well.
Your mother was religious, and I gather that you're not. How did that difference play out between you?
Mom was a very devout Christian. She was an elder of the Presbyterian Church, and I am, I guess, what you would call an agnostic, but a particularly lazy agnostic, because I really spend very little time thinking about any of it. And I mentioned that the choice of books was haphazard in our book club. We really read whatever we stumbled across. But after a certain period of time, I realized Mom kept introducing books about faith into the book club, especially about her faith. And I realized that she was trying very gently to steer me in that direction, not so much because she was trying to convert me, but because her faith had been such a great comfort to her that I think she really wanted the same thing for me.
One of the titles that really caught my eye, Will, is The Etiquette of Illness. Can you tell us about that book?
I was so glad to stumble across this book very early on. In fact, one of Mom's doctors suggested we all read it. And The Etiquette of Illness is a nonfiction book that explains how you need to be around people who are sick or, in fact, people who are dying. And the best tip I picked up from this book, it's by a woman named Susan Halpern, is not to ask my mother, how are you feeling? But to ask her, do you want to talk about how you're feeling? And that gave her the control. That meant some days she could say, yeah, I do want to talk about how I'm feeling. Or some days she could say, no, not today. And mean by that, I'm too busy living to want to talk today about my illness. And I picked up that tip and so many others from that book.
Well, those are useful tips, aren't they? Because I know a lot of us, and I'd count myself in this, don't quite know how to be with people who are seriously ill, and perhaps people you should call on, you don't call on. I mean, there are people who don't fall into that category. My sister's terrific at calling on people. I'm not so good at it.
One of the big lessons I learned, and it's something I really hope to convey, is it's almost always better to say something rather than nothing. And it's almost always better to say the wrong thing rather than nothing. And that was another lesson I learned from The Etiquette of Illness. And also, sometimes it's okay to say nothing if you're just there. Sometimes just showing up and sitting with somebody, holding their hand, watching television with them, just being there is a very important thing to do. And especially near the end, Mom and I would spend a lot of time reading together. I wasn't reading to her. She wasn't reading to me. We were simply sitting near each other, reading the same book.
Now, I'm interested in this material that you cover about refugees. She's very preoccupied with a project, in fact, to bring books to Afghanistan. And that project really haunts the book in some way. Can you tell us about that?
It's really a theme of the book is Mom wanted to do one last really big thing before she died. And Mom felt, too, that with books come responsibility. That if you read a book like The Kite Runner by Khaled Hosseini, which takes place in Afghanistan, it's not enough just to be moved. You can't get to the end of the book and say, oh, that was so moving, and then go back to your life. Mom felt if you were moved by a book like that, you had to do something about the situation in Afghanistan, for example. So she had met in her travels an extraordinary woman named Nancy Hatch Dupree, whose dream it was to build a kind of national library and research center in Kabul, Afghanistan. And Mom decided her last big thing was going to be to help Nancy Hatch Dupree fulfill that dream. And one of the kind of miracles of the book is working her cell phone from chemo, Mom, in fact, was able to do exactly that.
Well, as I say, she was an extraordinary woman. Now, the other thing that's extraordinary about your mother is that she always read the end of a book first.
Yes, at first that drove me crazy. She was one of those people who just couldn't wait to find out what happened. So she always read the end of every book first. And I make the comment early on that when you have pancreatic cancer of the type Mom had, which is always fatal, it's like reading the end of a book first. I mean, she knew exactly what lay in store for her. And yet she was determined to enjoy whatever days, weeks, or months she had left. And similarly, when she read a book, I think because she knew what was going to happen, she enjoyed the book more than I did. She was able to savor the prose and savor the characters and the observations. Whereas when I'm reading a book, I race ahead to try to find out what on earth is going to happen. So in a way, it's a bit of a metaphor for our two different approaches to life.
Well, Will, it's a very generous book, and I'm delighted you were able to come on board and share it with us.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Will Shelby. His book is called The End of Your Life Book Club. It's a lovely title, isn't it? It's published by Two Roads, which is an imprint of Hachette. Well, now to verse novels. As the words suggest, it's a novel written in verse, or poetry, rather than prose. One person who made her name with the verse novel was the late Australian poet Dorothy Porter. Her genre-bending books The Monkey's Mask and El Dorado are two very good examples. Now, Kristen Henry has added her own voice to this tradition with her novel in poems. It's called All the Way Home. It's about American Jesse Bryant's search for a home, first in the US and then in a commune on the south coast of New South Wales. It begins in the 1950s and takes us through the hippie days of the 70s right up to the present. Kristen Henry is a poet and musician born in Chattanooga in Tennessee. Isn't that a wonderful name for a place, Chattanooga? And she now calls Australia home. Sarah Lestrange spoke to Kristen Henry about her journey of creating All the Way Home.
Tell me, why did you want to tell this story in this way, as a story in poems?
Well, it didn't start out as a novel that I decided I'd write in verse. It's more the other way around. I'm a poet and I wanted longer than a page. You know, I had an idea, not the whole novel by any chance, but I had an idea of a character based on someone I'd met, and I started writing, and it just started stretching. And so by the time I had written, say, 10 poems, I thought I'd really like that larger canvas. And Dorothy Border had sort of paved the way a little with the idea of the verse novel. And I had in the past written short stories in verse. So I thought, why not?
Who was this character then who set you on the path to thinking, I want a broader canvas for this person?
Well, I have to say, I know nothing much about this fellow, but I met him very briefly. He was an American who had just left a cult after 25 years of being involved in it with his wife and his child. And I was fascinated by what kind of dilemma that would leave him with, coming back into a world after living in this very enclosed society. He was also a guitar player. Those two things, I don't know, he just sounded fascinating. I never got to ask him any questions, which is probably just as well, because I got to make it up. In the event that I started writing, it changed hugely from what I thought I was going to write about. And so All the Way Home became about different sorts of things, certainly not a kind of Jonestown situation, but something else that I was very interested in and have been forever, which is the idea of making your own family when you don't have any around you. You may notice I'm not from here. So the book kind of gathered together a lot of my interests.
How many roads must a man walk down before they call him a man?
So this person you met morphs into Jesse Bryant.
He does.
He's from America, and that's where we meet him. His father is a classic Rolling Stone, so 6 months anywhere and the old man started to twitch. That's a line from your book. So take us into Jesse Bryant's world.
Okay, well, he and his father, who's a traveling salesman, hit the road together. So he grows up with the idea that he is a freewheeler, unattached, and when his father dies, Jesse continues that way for a little while, and then because traveling to Australia had been an idea that his father was kind of interested in, it was farther away than anywhere else, Jesse decided he'd do that. There was nothing keeping him in America, so he'd go as far away as he could go without being on the way back.
And he lands in a beautiful place, the south coast of New South Wales, which is paradise, really. And I guess in that search for home, he comes across Flannery, girl from Ireland, escaping the troubles of mm-hmm. Northern Ireland. And he comes across Leon, an enigmatic, messianic figure who wants to set up an intentional community on the coast. And they all gather together. I think we've all met Leon types. Tell me about your understanding of Leon, this messianic figure.
Well, I wanted somebody who had the ability to excite and engage people. And at first when I was thinking about this community, it had more cultish overtones. And then I realized that didn't interest me, these extreme characters. Not extreme in that way. I was interested in someone whose ideals were what moved them through life and allowed them to move other people. And then I wanted to look at what happened when those ideals let them down.
Yeah, he's very powerful and he really motivates the community and it becomes a really thriving town which makes its own food and has markets and plays music for the community. But eventually it does become cut off and this causes rifts within the community of Heartsong that mm-hmm. they've created. Mm-hmm. But it also creates rifts within the community of Jesse and Flannery mm-hmm. who marry and mm-hmm. have a child.
Well, I think that, you know, there are sacrifices that people have to make when there's something that they think of as the common good. And so family life, although on the one hand, I envisaged this community engendering a very big sense of extended family. It's also in the kind of hierarchical way, takes precedence over that little nuclear family. So there's going to be some friction, and indeed there is.
Let's hear something from All the Way Home.
Okay, well, I'm going to read this one, which describes the day that Jesse meets this charismatic figure called Leon. Gives you a little sense of both of the fellows, I think. It was a blue day the first time Jesse saw this man, barefoot on the beach with people leaving the road in ones and twos, climbing over rocks to walk beside him. At any rate, that's what Jesse remembers, a man moving easy at the center of a growing organism. A tall man with tied back silver hair, his head inclined a little toward first one, then another, like someone in the habit of bending to listen. Jesse joined the picture, curious, striding backwards in the sand so he wouldn't lose the man's face. Who, he thought, and what? But knowing, oh, you bet, knowing, the man was a razor blade, a struck match. The instant they locked eyes, Jesse was scraped back to his beginning. He was ignited. Afterwards, he walked for hours into the early dark, his body tight, excited as a faggot of hissing sparklers. His feet finally stumbled him home. He needed to tell Flannery this astonishing thing, explain how he'd been thrilled beyond desire, beyond any fear he'd ever known. But his brave girl beat him to it. She said, "The baby's coming."
Kristen Henry reading from her book, All the Way Home. This journey that Jesse takes, it all revolves around this idea of home and his searching for it, as well as the other characters. How long did it take for you to bring this all together?
Oh, so long, it's embarrassing. I guess from the time I first started writing on it till the time it was finished is probably over 10 years, maybe 12 years.
What took so long? What was it about the book that was difficult to manage?
Working full time, and I wrote other things. I had a lovely big burst about halfway through winter season. Was lucky enough to have a place to stay where I knew no one for a couple of weeks, and I just typed my heart out, and that gave me a good spurt on, so I was able to keep moving with it. But really, time.
What comes through in reading it is it's a very clear story. It's beautifully written. It's all been crystallized. And I guess that shows that you've really worked hard at bringing it to that. So what was involved in terms of shaping this book that isn't a novel, but this book that isn't a poetry collection? It really is a story told through poems. How do you bring that novelistic element in?
There was a big learning curve for me. It's very different from writing the individual poems, and it was, I'd write a poem, it'd lead me off in some other direction, I'd think, where does this leave them, what could happen now. It really was, in a lot of ways, it was getting to know the characters the way you get to know friends.
You're out on the streets looking good, and baby, deep down in your heart, I guess you know that it ain't right.
Janis Joplin's Piece of My Heart. Ending Cyril Estrange's conversation with Kristen Henry. All the Way Home is the book. It's published by the University of Western Australia Press. Tomorrow, more gems from the past year. Puerto Rican jazz pianist Eddie Palmieri joins us. He's great. He'll play some mumbo too. And comedian and author Michael Palin, he's my guest on the program tomorrow. I'm Michael Cathcart. This is RN. It's just coming up to news time. Bye now.